Hi everyone, thanks for coming back and not staying out in the lovely sunshine, although it's tempting. So I'm Donna Linus, I'm a director at Wising, and I'm chairing this final session, which is called DIY to DIT, so from do it yourself to do it together. And this session is sort of bringing us up to date, and I thought maybe I should just give a little bit of background into the whole Wising Poly thing and why this session kind of came about within the context of Gavin's sort of curation of the day. So Wising, you know, we put a lot of structures in place to allow these kind of discussions to take place, but always thinking about the kind of relevance of the moment. And we theme each year into kind of, it kind of emerges from the previous year in a quite organic way, actually from these kind of events. So I am pretty certain that some of the things that will have been discussed today will eventually emerge into next year's theme and programming. And really what we're trying to do actually with the poly is that emerged from a sort of an event that happened last summer when we started talking in an event quite like this around where were the radical spaces of art practice happening now. And because in the past, perhaps we looked to the art college for that space. And, you know, I think what we've heard is that at the time, people were also looking for that in art colleges, but perhaps from, you know, someone like me looking back with a nostalgia and rose-tinted spectacles, you know, perhaps it wasn't like that in the way that we think it was. And it was a very problematic time as well, of course. In terms of which voices were heard in the structures. So in a way, what we're trying to do here and through the Poly program is to set up alternative structures to allow these kind of discussions to take place that will then feed into a wider discourse in terms of art practice. And obviously, you know, it's no accident that we're looking to the 1970s as a period not to be forgotten or allowed to disappear, you know, that to keep it alive by talking about it because of the reemergence of the left over the recent years in Europe. And at the time when we put together the concept of the poly, you know, there was a real genuine optimism around a potential new era of the left in the UK. And I guess we thought, but at this point, we would be, you know, we'd have all had our sleeves rolled up, start to think about a different future for this country, and that we'd all be, you know, working forever naive and optimistic, of course. But in a way, that is happening, I guess. But it's happening in a more, in a way that's much more immersed and, you know, it's much more sort of crossing lots of different disciplines. It looks at, you know, music is extremely important, writing is important. There's a kind of reemergence of poetry that's happening that's really important. So in a way, we're also trying to capture that moment and think, well, you know, what is happening now? What does it mean? How can the arts play a role within politics and sort of offer alternatives where things aren't working? So for example, we set up in collaboration with a group of peers across the UK an alternative learning program that was about trying to set up an opportunity for someone who couldn't afford to do an MA or didn't want to come and work with us and, you know, and the partners in a collaborative way to go through a process that might be similar to an MA or what we thought would be the dream MA, you know, that we would have all loved to have done if we'd had the opportunity. So in a way, you know, I think there is a sort of an urgency around arts organisation taking the initiative on these kinds of, offering these kind of alternatives and allowing different voices to come out in programming that's not about purely exhibition-driven programmes, although of course there's a place for that. And I think there are, you know, there's a lot of good things happening across the UK and we can celebrate it and talk about it and think about what the next phase, you know, in terms of the politics might be. And I guess we can't really get away from the fact that, you know, the struggles that are happening right now within the UK in terms of like this kind of re-emergence of the left and how that connects to Europe and what's going on there. So perhaps it would be good to touch on that a little bit. I'm really happy to have some speakers here today whose work completely is, you know, is doing everything that we've been talking about. And then we've also got Amy Proctor, whose book.
Spencer.
Oh, sorry. No, but you're Proctor. Sorry. Sorry.
I wasn't sure if I should say.
No, yeah. You should. Sorry, Amy Spencer.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry.
Sorry about that. Whose book here? You know, The Rise of Lo-Fi Culture, which Amy, you know, is going to be able to give us a little bit of flavour of kind of the emergence of lo-fi culture coming out of, surprisingly to me, actually was the States in the 1930s. I don't know if you want to go back that far, but it also relates to something that someone else said around, you know, tapping into a moment in the 1970s when, in fact, there was an influence coming from places like San Francisco or bands like the Velvet Underground Company from New York. You know, in a way, that had a huge effect on UK culture, so it would be really great to hear more about that. And also, thinking about how the visual played a role in this kind of milieu that we're talking about. So looking, you know, at some of Kevin's aesthetics, it's very much like the aesthetic that still kind of continues around this DIY culture in terms of the handmade, and how holding on to that aesthetic seems really important as well. So we're going to start with Amy. Shall I just hand over straight to you?
Yes, or do we need that instead of...
Shall we try it with these mics first?
Because it looks like it's on. Maybe it is. Who knows? Hand me that if people can't hear. So I wanted to start by introducing some of the ideas from my book, which... So this is a book I wrote, DIY, The Rise of Lo-Fi Culture. It was quite a while ago. So the first edition was published in 2006, so... There is a cut-off point. I've still been involved in DIY culture after that, but if you read that, you'll realise that there's not so much about the internet, because, you know, I haven't just forgotten to put a lot of things in it. That's when I wrote it. I wanted to start off by introducing some of the ideas of that book in particular, thinking about do-it-yourself culture and sort of exploring a little bit about what those ideas mean to me. Because as I started writing this book, I realised that it meant different things to different people over different times in particular. And I started tracing where some of the ideas came from. So to me, it's about using anything you can get your hands on to shape your own cultural product and whatever version, whatever you think is missing from a kind of wider mainstream culture. It's about the urge to produce something for yourself and in turn pass it on to other people. It's about championing a sense of independence. If you don't see yourself represented in the media, it's about creating your own media. It's about using resources available to you, even though those might be limited resources. And it's about crossing the boundary between who consumes and who creates. That's the thing that kind of excites me, that it's not a certain person who produces and creates something. Anybody can take part, and there's this kind of ethos, a kind of championing of anybody taking part. It's about the amateur approach being valued as a finished product and not as a stepping stone on the way to being a professional. It questions the idea of the expert, and it's about people experimenting with what they can do themselves. It's about getting involved, and it's about community. And as I was doing my research for that book, I realised that this idea had kind of spread through different creative and political communities, and people who are working as individuals and also as groups had used this kind of idea to create their own cultural forms. And the kind of activity that I looked at is vast, and it covers activities such as music, self-publishing, zine making, journalism, filmmaking, activism, crafting, art and technology. So many things can be DIY. It's evolved through digital culture, and opportunities available online now completely kind of exploded what I think of as DIY. Changes in technology have always played a really important part in do-it-yourself culture. Different waves of kind of creative output have always coincided with developments in technology. So as cassette tapes became more affordable, then, you know, bands used cassette tapes to record and produce as a means to distribute music. So it kind of spent a lot of time kind of tracing how technology impacted DIY culture. And the book in particular explores the idea of DIY in publishing and music within the UK and US. And the aim of it was to try and work out what the roots of do-it-yourself culture were, because I noticed there were different ways of working that kind of echoed through different communities, similar ways of working, familiar styles that appeared in lots of different forms. So, for example, I looked at how the zine, a kind of small-scale, cheaply produced publication, was first produced by sci-fi fans in the 1930s in America and developed into a format used by anyone, and then those were used to inspire music zines, and fiction writers and activists used the same kind of cheaply produced format. And then I looked at punk zines in the 70s and saw how the aesthetics of those were directly taken from earlier art movements, such as Futurists, Dada, Situationists, Fluxus art movements. I saw that activities started by pirate radio stations were then later used in podcasts, so I was kind of got really interested in tracing how things were repeating, different people were doing different things at different times. This book wasn't a kind of critical engagement with the subject, it was just me as somebody who had a personal background in do-it-yourself culture, so from writing zines when I was a teenager to releasing records and just the idea that you could do something yourself from your hometown and kind of send it out into the world really gripped me from quite a young age, so I was really inspired by that. And so later on, I really wanted to kind of explore how other people had used this. And as I wrote about DIY culture, and one of the things that I realised was really important, as it was important to me, is the idea of trying to find a community, a kind of sense of that there are other people a bit like you out there. And a key strength of DIY for me is that it celebrates this kind of artistic activist community. So this could be a close physical community in a city where you have opportunities to share resources, music equipment, printing equipment, physical spaces, or it could be this kind of kind of a wider sense of community that supports individual activities. So a zine writer, someone producing these kind of publications, might live a long way away from a sense of physical community, but might feel connected to a wider community. So they might, for example, when I wrote zines, the postal network was how I communicated to people. I sent my zines to people and they sent zines back to me, and we kind of connected this really big, this was in kind of the mid-90s in the UK. You could communicate with people you didn't really know just by writing letters to them, and they would send 50p and they'd send a zine, and then the back page of a zine you would find all the addresses for zines to send your 50p to, and it was fun. And also I started exploring the sense of collaboration within the DIY community. So due to this blurring of the division between who creates and who consumes, between who's an amateur and who's an expert, and a democratic ideal of who should be involved, there's this feeling that people are willing to be open and collaborate with each other. And it's difficult to assess whether this is always the case, whether it's a kind of idealised feeling or whether it's, you know, it's actually what happens. But there are all these... you kind of see the output of people collaborating with each other. And there are thousands of writers and musicians who wouldn't have created, I don't think, without the supportive ethos behind them, this idea that anyone can do it. And there's this kind of rallying call to become involved. And this forms a sense of doing it together rather than just having to do it all yourself, this kind of feeling that you're in it with other people. And in particular, I think that the building of a zine community, which was what I was particularly involved in, is due to the personal nature of many zines. So it's a kind of cultural product that is often a documentation of everyday life. An academic and writer, Chris Atten, recognises that personal paper-based zine is a form of cultural production firmly rooted in everyday life. So writers often write about their own experiences and produce elements of their own life in paper form. Writers might be writing about their own lives, what's important to them, and the music that they're listening to. So lots of zines that I looked at in this book particularly were quite personal zines. People just writing about aspects of their own life or kind of niche interests that they had that they wanted to share with other people. So it might be a particular television programme they were watching and got really obsessed with and wanted to share, or a particular interest that they had and wanted to reach out to other people. And one of my favourite things about zines is you can see the evidence of the creator in them. So in the history of zine writing, emerging in the, particularly as we know it, emerging in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s when I was writing zines, there's been this kind of dominant visual style, in part inspired by earlier art movements, and this often still remains in zines today. So text can often be handwritten, cut and paste techniques are used, and you can see how the zines are constructed. And there's often a sense of immediacy and urgency in DIY cultural products, that they can't survive long term and they need to say whatever they want. They need to say everything they can in a kind of immediate a short space of time, this kind of urgency runs through them. And the aesthetic of a zine often implies this sense of immediacy, the feeling that everything has to be said right now and it won't last forever. Energy is kind of concentrated and released in this burst of activity. And particular zines might not last for very long, just maybe a few issues. But there's always this kind of optimism that in this short space of time they'll kind of reach their audience and the people writing them will find the community that they were looking for and kind of the achieve what the zine particularly is about. I think I'll leave it there for that introduction. And then hopefully we'll hear some more about practical examples. Thank you.
Just before we move on, actually, just one thing that you said towards the end that I think would be good to maybe unpick a little bit more, especially in this context of alternative learning or structures for, because in a way, what Green described when he moved to London and set up Scriticality as a kind of cooperative movement, you know, working in squats, and it struck me that was almost like setting up your own art school, post-art school or something. Yeah, it felt very much like a learning experience. And then when I was reading your book, I was thinking, well, actually, you know, the process of producing zines and the fact that everyone who contributes then writes for someone else and their zine, and then it becomes this really concrete, almost like a physical object, the network becomes incredibly concrete. And in a way, is that also offering a different kind of vehicle for a learning platform almost? Or am I reading too much?
No, it's interesting. I think because I don't have an art school background, so it's not a way I've thought of it before, but definitely the kind of network, particularly when I was writing scenes, did feel like a kind of a really important thing, but more from a sense of community and a feeling of making connections with people you might not usually meet.
There was almost a currency about, well, I'll support your zine if my writing is... And then you would sort of naturally put that person in your next edition kind of thing. And that sort of strengthened this kind of...
Yeah, I definitely see that. But I can see how that would work, the kind of sharing of ideas. And but I think for me it didn't feel like that at the time. Like now looking back on it, I would read it as that, and I would think, oh yeah, I was trying to, it was about learning and sharing ideas and trying out things. But then when I think about what I was actually writing when I was 16, it didn't feel as serious as that, even though it felt, it wasn't so much the testing of ideas, it was more kind of documenting how I was feeling about things.
And making connections.
Making connections with other people and then, kind of growing into the world through that.
Okay. All right. Does anyone want to ask a question, pitch in at this point? Of course, Gavin.
I mean, it's a remarkable project, initiative, whatever we want to call it. But I just wanted to say two things. Firstly is that and I think it echoes what I think it was Chris that said this earlier, that, you know, a lot of the energy that goes into, a lot of the labour that goes into the making of this thing goes into the kind of making and the sustaining of the group, right? And but perhaps more particularly of the infrastructure of the group, because as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, you're in multiple music bands, but you're also a kind of key member of the collective of DIY Space for London as well. Whereas, you know, in the previous historical moment we've been considering, correct me if I'm wrong, but for the most part, it seemed to be that you were either in a band or you were somebody who was involved in kind of setting up the infrastructure. That might not be true, but I'm thinking about Tony Wilson, people like that with Factory Records, people who set up Rough Trade. Right, scratch that then. Okay, leave that one. Okay, it's exactly the same. Leave that one.
But we do actually need more spaces like this, don't we? Because that's really the only way that we're going to get through the next few years. And someone said earlier, actually it was you, Claire, about, you know, the responsibility of the older generation to support, not just about giving platforms for this kind of work, but also actually funding it. You know, and you, there is a precedent actually, which is that that well-known YBA artist Gary Hume gives £70,000 of his own money to Goldsmiths for artists to have who couldn't afford it to have bursaries to study. And I really think somehow we need to draw on that and actually, and push it really hard and sort of start to say like how do we actually somehow work together to think about how to keep these kind of spaces alive and from not to get squashed out of the system, because things are going to get really tough again. Evelyn's got a question.
Hi. Okay, I was really hoping I wouldn't have to say this, or at least I was hoping it wouldn't have to be me that would have to say this, but I just wanted to kind of draw attention to the whiteness of this event. And even as I'm saying this, I'm like frustrated and exhausted. And especially kind of thinking about this moment of ongoing crisis that we're in, and just this is just not good enough. Like, it's just really not good enough right now, you know? And to kind of have this event framed around welfare and austerity measures and you know, living in this moment where actually these measures are only going to get worse, and we're not really thinking about the people who are disproportionately affected by these measures, and actually none of their voices are part of this conversation, you know? So I'm thinking, like, what's going on? You know, and actually also just to be clear, I'm actually only here because I'm on a residency here. You know, I wouldn't have been here had I been in London, which is where I'm usually based. So it's also important to kind of draw attention to that. So my question is, like, why are we here? Because there's a lot of we that's being mentioned, but actually, who is that we? It's like, what are we doing? What is the aim of this conversation that's happening today? And actually, who is it that we're trying to speak to? You know, who is it that we actually want to be in solidarity with when we're talking about collectivism and working together? It's like, who is it that you actually want to work with? And actually, I feel like part of this issue is one of legibility. You know, how, because I'm seeing these moments in time that are being mentioned around, you know, music, around punk, and around, and actually I'm seeing a really particular kind of punk, because actually my definition of punk looks really different, you know. So I'm thinking about how is it that radicality is perceived? How is it that anarchism is perceived? Is it to be squatting? Is it to be, you know, being able to work for free? And it's like, actually, for some people, that is just not an option, you know. So again, I'm thinking about legible, you know, what does it mean to appear? What does it mean to be visible to certain kind of modes of thought? And also I'm thinking about that actually a lot of the people that are being brought up in terms of the theory are particularly Western, particularly white continental philosophers. And actually, you know, there's not been any kind of mention of a kind of, and I think, you know, it needs to be part of this conversation we're having, especially in this moment around kind of post-D and anti-colonial kind of thinkers, you know, really need to be brought into the conversation. Like, for example, Edouard Glisson's notion of opacity, you know, this, you know, what does it mean to not be understood, and actually to have the right to not be understood, and actually how do we figure out ways to work together collectively when we don't understand each other? We might not necessarily speak the same language, you know, and how we appear and how our politics manifest might be different, but we need to figure something out, you know what I mean? Like, we really, really do, because not everybody has the luxury to engage in these activities like squatting and, you know, all of these things that, I don't know, they seem so much a part of this conversation, but actually they're not part of everybody's conversation, you know, so I just want to make that clear as well. And I'm frustrated because this keeps on happening, you know, it keeps on happening, and actually this is partly why we're here. You know what I mean? Like, this is partly why we're here in this moment in time, because we're not really having conversations, you know, outside of our kind of immediate comfortable groups. And so the point that I want to make, it's not really a question, sorry, it's just because I've been kind of holding this in for the whole day, and I just want to say that we can't keep organising events in the same way, with the same unbalanced set of speakers. We can't keep writing the same set of books that don't look at histories intersectionally. You know what I mean? And kind of, you know, we can't keep not moving beyond the legible, you know, and what we understand. So, yeah.
thank you for that contribution. I mean, you are a part of the conversation by being here and making contributions of that kind. I'm very, very conscious of the whiteness of the panel, and obviously I would have preferred it to be otherwise. It's an extremely short panel, as you know, 12 till 5, and that doesn't excuse anything, but it means that the kind of the range of perspectives that we've been able to consider have been necessarily kind of partial and very far from comprehensive, and that's why it was so important to open up the discussion to the people who came along today, because you're absolutely right that the histories of punk and post-punk in particular are incredibly important in terms of a bigger story of the development of multicultural Britain, for example, especially when we bring into the picture the communities around reggae music. And what's so kind of interesting, I think, just going back to Leeds, which is what I would have loved to have brought to the table, is, for example, at that time, I talked about the amount of working class students that were allowed to go to art school, you know, back in the day when it was free, but that economic, if you like, the lack of an economic barrier didn't mean it was necessarily any more kind of pluralistic in terms of, of race and ethnic background. The students who were going to university were still largely white at that time, not exclusively so. And why was it that there wasn't more non-white people getting involved in post-punk music? Because in large part what was happening in Leeds, for example, there were experimental black collectives going on, but in relationship to dance, for example, Tyrone Huggins was in Impact. They're, absolutely. But what I'm talking about is a community that didn't go to art school in Leeds, but made radical experimental collectivist work, came out of Hare Hills and Chapel Town schools. Yes, I do know what you mean, and if I was to organise the event over again, I would most definitely have somebody, maybe even Christy Adair or somebody from that community to come and speak about that practice.
I'm totally ashamed, partly because I wrote about a lot of black practice in my own collective thing, but I am really ashamed, actually, that I didn't rehear what I needed to say myself. But the thing I really want to say is that it's not about the black community, it's about, she's talking about black intellectuals, actually. And I actually think about Black Audio Film Collective, who I wrote about here. But I don't think it's about reggae music and the black community, it's about actually contribution to intellectual ideas. And I'm really sorry that I forgot to hear that, because it's just, if it's too easy for me not to hear it, then it's really easy for everybody not to hear it.
Well, let me tell you that John Acomfra was invited to be here today, and obviously the Black Audio Film Collective was one of the first collectives that I wanted to be represented here. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it. So that's the truth of the matter.
You know, there were other people as well that could have been brought into the conversation. No, that's it. Thank you, Lotte.
We're about to finish. Like, it's 5 o'clock. We're supposed to finish now. Does anyone have anything else that they, you know, without taking off on a tangent? I guess we are going to stop now. Has anyone got anything else that they feel like they want? Yeah.
It's just very quick, but what is going to come out of this event, do you think? anyone.
Well, I mean, I suppose the point of having these kind of events is to bring people together, to have these conversations and start to unpick some of the... I mean, were you aware of DIY space before you came here? Well, are you aware? Or, I mean, that's why you came. I mean, it's about talk, about sort of bringing some of this stuff out so we can talk about it. So, yeah, I guess it's... there is another event coming up, and actually I've just realised we were supposed to talk a lot more about the role of online space as spaces of community, which is what the next event is about. So, yeah, the purpose of any kind of event like this is about starting conversations. So hopefully people will come back to future ones and we can continue the conversations, we can listen to what is being said, and obviously it also impacts in terms of, you know, there are people in this room who program arts organisations, so presumably they might start thinking about how they might take some of what we've been hearing back to their organisations as well. But it is, you know, it's supposed to be about sharing knowledge, ultimately.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the initial idea was that kind of...
The initial idea?
That sparked you to create this event.
So, yeah, so it was just... I guess it was because we were looking at this... like I was describing, last summer we had an event where we were starting thinking about where spaces of radical practice exist now, because we were talking about the demand, you know, sort of like this the journey that art schools have been on, from talking about art to talking about the creative industries and what's been lost in that process. So this kind of trying to look back somehow at something that happened pre-Thatcherism actually, and capitalism and neoliberalism in the UK, specifically rooted in UK art schools, and talking about Gavin's research around Leeds at the time. So yeah, that's why. But it was supposed to be looking back to a time that was definitely not perfect, but trying to just perhaps think about, is there something going on now that's allowing these kind of conversations to reemerge?
It feels like now that we're in such a kind of crisis state and everything's being thrown up in the air, there should be now, from going forwards, more opportunities to discuss issues and think about who's being represented and who's not being represented. And I feel like everyone here should commit themselves to not making mistakes, me too, that we need to address how we're representing, and especially in the time of current upheaval, it's an opportunity, not a good opportunity, but an opportunity to rethink how we're doing things and what we're doing, I think, personally. Yes. I'm feeling that in all of me now.
There's a lot, I've uncovered a lot of commonality between what's happening now and then. But there's one thing that is an extremely big difference, and it's something you were saying about being able to afford to do this. I mentioned it outside of this room, but I want to say it, but we have the dole.
Yeah.
40 quid a week. What's the teacher's allowance now? 75? And it was a very light touch dole.
Yeah.
You had to sign on, that was it.
You couldn't.
Yeah. All that shit. What was this?
Yeah,
we did.
It's not.
We wouldn't have been able to do it. We could at least feed ourselves and live in a place in what? And how you do it.
And a lot of work I've been doing after writing this book and being involved in DIY myself, realising how not everybody's voice is being heard. So spending a lot of time myself kind of working with different groups, particularly in kind of writing projects. So I spent the last 10 years working with kind of homeless groups and exploring the idea of how to share your writing and how to share your voices, and lots of just a huge variety of groups, feeling that I didn't just want to hear my voice all the time, but trying to engage with other people. And I feel like that's the kind of trying to find new spaces and new...
Gavin, do you want to say anything, actually?
I just want to say thank you to Donna and to Lottie and to all of the staff. here at Wysing for facilitating our conversations today. To all the contributors who shared their reflections with us, and obviously to everybody here who has contributed and who has sat and listened intently, and hopefully the conversations will continue, we'll learn from today, and we'll see what happens.